So we started off last Friday having the knowing that the kinematic Hilbert space gives you a graph, which is just a collection of vertices and edges. And now we want to obtain the physical Hilbert space by applying the Gauss constraints, which has this form right here, where E and A are the spin connections and like the densitized dryads, the densitized dryads. Yeah. So now, if you want to quantize this, it's going to be hard because there's a derivative here, and those are actually not the smear variables that we have been dealing with. So an easier way to do that is to recognize that the Gauss constraints give you generates the rotation in the internal space, the SU space. So what we can do is that we consider the gauge transformation of a holonomy, which has this form, where this form here is for holonomy from some source vertex to a target vertex. And we consider a state, which is just a function of the holonomy, and it transforms in this way. And from this, we can see that you can write it in terms of the left and right action acting on that state. And what we want to do here is to find states that invariant under this action. And we use the technique called group averaging. And this is an example that I really like that illustrates how it works. So let's say that we want to find an average function of this function f, h. H is just the holonomy. That is invariant under the right action. Then what we would do is that we would integrate this over the group elements using the Haar measure. And what you can see here is that if I act, if I use a right action and act on into this average action, it will actually just go into here. And because the Haar measure is invariant under this action, you can see that this new average function is actually invariant under the right action. So using this idea, we obtain the projector that will keep these states invariant under the action that we write down for this transformation. Now, this is specifically for a holonomy from a source vertex to a target vertex. So what we want to do is to consider just one vertex. That's why we just want to consider with one vertex with more edges. There are some incoming edges and outgoing edges. And that's why we want to do a tensor product between these left and right action corresponding to those incoming and outgoing holonomies. And we give an example on a vertex where are there three holonomies coming out of that vertex, where we have this projector. We act on the state, the tensor product state of these holonomies. And after some algebra, we get this form here, where these matrices or these symbols are the three JM Wigner symbols. And what we can see from here is that since we said that this projector is a proper projector, when we square it, we actually get another projector. So from this, we can find what is the normalized state that would be invariant under the Gauss constraints. And this is the form of it. And what you can see here is that you actually contract this second index, this second magnetic number, that since Gauss constraints generate rotation, this contraction actually keep the state invariant under this Gauss constraints. And now just want to have a final note that I just want to draw this picture. So the Gauss constraints, when we just use the infinitesimal, so in a different picture, not considering the whole gauge transformation, but consider the infinitesimal translation due to this gauge transformation, we actually find out that the total flux coming in or coming out of these vertex actually is zero. And since these flux variables corresponding to the length of these dual edges, this constraint actually imply that the edges have to close and form a closed triangle. Now, I think in this lecture, we will use a flatness constraint and try to glue these triangles together. Yep.
Okay, great. So indeed, to get to the physical phase space, we're still missing one constraint, which is this flatness constraint. And in the case of 3D gravity, it amounts to kind of solve the dynamics. And so yeah, this is the step we're going to do today. So today the idea is to kind of what we are left with is the flatness constraint. And so as Nam mentioned here, in the case of the Gauss constraint, the Gauss constraint is generating SU2 invariants. So the gauge orbit associated to this constraint is compact. And so indeed, the projector that we define is a real projector. Okay, but of course, it's not going to be the case for the flatness constraint. So what my point here is that indeed here, so we started from this kind of kinematical Hilbert space associated for graph. We impose one of the constraints, and then the Hilbert space associated with this new graph, new function that are now the spin network function, are going to be still using the same. We can still use the same inner product as for the kinematical one, just because we have this property, because we're working with compact gauge group. And if you remember the case of the parametrized particle, where here it was invariant under reparametrization, okay, you remember that we really mimic this procedure, the Dirac procedure, by first finding what was the kinematical Hilbert space, then implementing the constraint at the quantum level. Then to get what we call the quantum Hilbert space, we need to impose the constraint, okay? And to impose the we need to find an inner product. And the inner product, if we use the kinematical inner product in this case, then we were finding some divergences. And it's going to be the case in the flatness constraint. So for the flatness constraint, we have kind of, we will have a bit more work that in the case of the Gauss constraint, okay? So what are we trying to impose? So again, as for the Gauss constraint, if we look at the classical expression of the Gauss constraint, of the flatness constraint, is going to be also a complicated function now, just of the connection, but also with derivative and everything. And it's nonlinear function, so it's going, again, to be complicated to quantize that directly. But we have shown, you have shown in tutorial, hopefully, that for an holonomy associated to a curve, it can be, so what is the property we have shown? It's that if now, well, this is a closed curve, what you can approximate, and this is very easy to show in the case of if we were working with an abelian group. Of course, with SU2, it's not abelian, but still, you can show it that, plus some correction, epsilon 3, where here epsilon would be the of kind of length, where here it's the curvature tensor that we have here. So we see that imposing the constraint, the flatness, okay, meaning that this is zero, would require that the holonomy around this this loop is trivial. Okay, so here, this means that if we want to impose flatness, we can impose that any holonomy around closed loop has to be identity. So here we're going to impose okay, so let's now look at, so this is what we're going to, the property we're going to use. And let's see that on a concrete example. And we're going to work on the tetrahedral network. So I'm going to, so it can be seen as So what is nice with a tetrahedron is that it's dual to a tetrahedron. So it means that if you triangulate, for example, like a sphere, then the spin network associated to your, by just a single tetrahedron, the spin network associated to your sphere will be also a tetrahedron. Okay, so this is the spin network we're going to consider. So let's give some orientation to our link. So I need to keep the same one as I have here, otherwise we're going to be lost. 2J4J6, I'm calling this one V. So this one is the one where with the same orientation that we did explicitly in the previous example. So the intertrainer associated to this vertex is going to be exactly the same as we got before. So V2, V4, V6. So I have V1 here. Yeah, the way. Right now it seems a bit random, my choice of, I guess it was not random here. So here, how many loops can you define? How closed loop can you define? How many faces do you have on this? It's a tetrahedron. So four? Yeah. So we have four loops. Let's write them explicitly. So what is going to be the holonomy? H1, so around this, the face at the back, okay? So I got, so I'm starting here, J6, J5, and then I have G4 minus 1, okay? Because it's the reverse. So I'm turning this way on the back face, then H2 is going to be this face now. So again, the orientation, you have to be careful with the orientation here for your the holonomy. Then so now I'm going to do this face. Okay, so I'm doing the three faces that we share V, the vertex V. So here now I have so G2, G3 inverse, G4 inverse, and I'm left with the bottom face. Okay, we're here. So I started from this vertex, so going this way. So G1 minus 1. So if we follow what we did with the Gauss constraint, okay, where we define this delta this way, here naively what we would do is going to be kind of, so I'm starting from a given state and then I'm going to act with four delta function on this state to find the physical state. Okay, and then where here the delta, by this delta function, what I mean is the delta function over the group. Okay, so this means that here, what I define, so G is SU2, but it can be any compact group in many cases. Okay, so this is what I mean by a delta function over a group element. And I think in one tutorial you kind of express this in terms of character over the group. If you use kind of the Peter Weiss theorem for this function, it's what you get. Okay, so do you see any issue here with what we with just this prescription. Do you see any issue? Are they all independent here? Because, yeah, if we have some redundancy, this is also going to be a source of divergence. So we already mentioned that one source of divergence is going to be, so not to define the physical state, but to define the inner product, will be that the gauge group, the gauge orbit are not compact. So we'd have to find a different inner product than the kinematical inner product. But here, already to define our physical state, we see that there are some redundancy here, because you can express H4 just going around the other faces. So what is the relation here? So here. Then C. So H4 can be expressed in terms of and so you see that if you impose that these three holonomies are identity, automatically this one is equal to identity. Okay, so we don't need to impose it in addition. So it's going to be.
Wait, is the last H you put there supposed to be H4 or?
Sorry.
The last H.
Oh yeah, it's not going to be supposed to be H6 for sure. I guess it's H2, so you can check. If you do H2, so you go around this space, then H3 was this space. So each time you go, you see that you go around and then around here. And then with H1 minus 1, you start with this way. And then you need to go back to, so these two holonomies are going to bring you to this starting point. Okay. So here, yeah, thanks. So H2 equal identity and H3 equal identity is going to indeed impose H4 is equal identity. Okay, so this means that we're going to define our physical state here as not this prescription. So we can correct this. And here we don't want this one. So instead of, we're going to add, impose only these three things. Okay, now let's mention the other issues that come from that the flatness constraint generate translation, so and that the gauge orbit associated to that are non-compact, as I mentioned it, and maybe to see the issue we can. So what is going to be the physical so here I haven't really written anything yet explicitly. Of course, what I'm going to do next is going to write explicitly what is the spin network associated to this given graph and see what would be transition amplitude between two different graphs if we impose the flatness. Okay, but let's first, to talk about transition amplitude, we need to have an inner product. Okay, so here, what is the physical inner product? And so if you remember the parameterized particle, you remember that you cannot use the kinematical one. And so here, I will let you go back to the to this example. And again, on Friday, I showed you that I told you to look at the parameterized particle case by using this delta, implementing. So here, if we do the same with our simple system where we're considering just one particle constrained by C equal PQ, so generating translation in Q, you remember that the physical state could be obtained by imposing a delta, a projector here. And what we were getting was, so we have some new. So where we're integrating over R of T Q plus S ds. Okay, these are the physical states, and we need to define now the physical Hilbert space within an inner product. So if we just, so this function R function in R square integrable function over R2. Okay, so if we use the kinematical inner product, what this would like. So this means that if we try to do something like this, let's see again what this is going to give and what is going to be the prescription here. So here, it means that I'm integrating over the kinematical Hilbert space, so the space of square integrable function over R2. So my inner product would be that I have two integral over R2, one coming from the inner product and two coming from the fact that I'm dealing with physical state here. And so what I guess and here I need to integrate over, in fact I'm integrating over all variables, so ds, so here I have s2 and s1, s2 dt dq. And obviously this is going to be infinite because you see that once you integrate over s1 and s2, then the integrand is independent of q. So again, you integrate over minus infinity to plus infinity with a integrand, which is a constant, so you get an infinity here. Okay, so what is the idea? So it's exactly the same thing that we were finding in the case of the parameterized particle. So how do you solve this issue here? What we're going to use is that, so usually we work with self-adjoint operator, meaning that we have this nice property. And if you remember, the inner product, the R measure that we found is make sure that our operators are self-adjoint for us. And we're going to use something formally, because in the case of non-compact gauge orbit, this delta is not really a project defining a real projector, but we want to say that it is indeed a projector. So projector meaning p square equal p. And so for that, we're going to say that our physical, so if now we do something like this with any constraint here, so what I'm writing here is two physical states, and I want that this inner product is a physical one, okay, because so what I'm going to define is that this is equal, so I'm using the fact that they are self-adjoint and that I see them as real projector. And when it's here, now I can use the kinematical kinematical Hilbert space, okay? So what does it mean in our specific case? In our specific case, if now I'm considering two states satisfying the that are going to be defined on this graph satisfying the Gauss constraint. So meaning that the state I'm considering on this graph are spin network state. Then what I'm going to say is that, so I'm going to impose, I want to define physical state for these two states. And I'm going to say that the physical inner product between that two physical states, so here physical, is going to be using the same prescription as here. So here, I guess I'm missing a state. Okay, so this is, if you want, I1 physical, and this one is and psi 1. And here, the kinematical one, which is the one just using the R measure. OK. Any question now?
Operators are self-adjoint, so you can move this across.
Yeah.
And then we say the projector squares to itself. So why don't these two things are equal, right?
Yeah. It's just that. So in the case of the Gauss constraint, indeed, we really have that is equal. But in our case, because it's a non-compact thing, in fact, it's not really true that we, so it's kind of a formal equality. But it's kind of as removing all the divergences that are here. So that's why saying that make that this we remove all the divergences, and it's kind of using that formally this is true. But in if you write think explicitly, it's not exactly you have divergences. Okay. So it's up to. So it's kind of saying that this is true up to infinity, is kind of. So it's kind of, is equal to infinity. So it's, and then you just say, okay, but let's forget the infinity part, and then write this.
And the group that we are averaging over is what?
So here we're dealing with translation for that. So it's translation for the co. Triad, so it's like kind of R. Okay, it's a real. It's also a translation symmetry that we have here. And if you, and you can show that doing the same prescription, but here using the constraint, whereas in the case of the parameterized particle, you indeed recover the physical inner product that you can also, that in our case, we just said, oh, we're going to borrow the one we know if we were just doing the reduced phase space procedure. Okay, because in the case of the parameterized particle, indeed we can solve the constraint and get back to the usual case of the just the free particle and then quantize that, and we know what is the inner product. So it's what we did when we look at the parameterized particle. But in case we don't know, we have this procedure that is also working. Okay, so let's so here it's generating translation or flatness constraints. So the gauge orbit are going to be R. Okay, so now what is this? So this is my graph. So what is what are these functions? Okay. Right, let's write them explicitly. So what I'm going to do now is write them explicitly and show, so, and we're going to get a result that is going to be maybe more clear once we will do the spin form analysis, because we're going to recover the kind of same object, okay? So meaning that the physical state we get here are going to be the building block of the spin network where we do this path integral thing. So it's going to become maybe more clear what this object means in this case, because here it's just going to be coming from recoupling theory, but then I'm going to spend some time kind of giving you classically what does it mean indeed. And I think Nam already mentioned it. It's going to tell you how to glue this triangle, but we can really write this explicitly using, in terms of the integral angles and this kind of thing. So let's first do the quantum part and then try to explain a bit the geometrical meaning behind, as we did for the flat, the Gauss, saying that classically it was telling you that your graph was dual to triangles, okay? And okay, so what is this thing? So it's going to be, so it's associated to this graph, which is a tetrahedron. So it's only going to depend on this six spin that are on my graph here, okay? And so how do I do that? This means that here all the, and contrary to the, yeah, so it's behind, but what Nam wrote, where we were just considering one given vertex and we imposed the Gauss constraint on that. The Gauss constraint on one vertex was contracting, so each edges M1, M2, each edge is, before imposing any Gauss constraint, is carrying two magnetic numbers. And so what the Gauss constraint are is contracting this magnetic number together and putting some condition constraint on which one are allowed, okay? So this is what the Gauss constraint is doing. And when we impose the Gauss constraint, we just look at one vertex. So indeed, we still add this magnetic number that were kind of free, okay, not contracted. But here, we're looking now at a specific case where it's a closed graph, and the Gauss constraint is going to be imposed at all vertices, okay? So none of the index magnetic number are free, and so that's why your final graph, your final spin network, is really just a function of your spins, yeah. Okay, so here this means that I can write this explicitly while summing over all magnetic number, and if I decompose that on my, the basis you use is that you take the tensor product of some gi, mi, ni for each edge, okay, associated to each edge. So here it's also what I have, but now there are this function are contracted with, are constrained by some function. And here, what is this function? It's going to be just a product of these intertwiners. Okay, so I, how many do I have here? So I have four vertices, so I'm going to get four 3J symbols. Okay, you remember that Gauss constraint is going to tell you that this is this object, which is a 3NJ symbol. Okay, so here it's just the kind of product, plus I have some sign that just come from the fact that only what I call vertex V, the above one, is going to be exactly of this form, okay, because for the other vertices, I have different orientations. So if you look at, yeah, so it's behind, but what Nam remind us is that, you don't really impose the same, it's not exactly the same constraint depending on the orientation. So the result is going to be very similar, just you have some sign coming out. So here, and then I'm going to have four of them. And so if I start with the vertex V, this one has indices V2, J2, J4, J6, okay? And it's the same expression as here, so I have some n. And now I need to go around all vertices, so I'll let you check that here. And I should get each spin twice, okay? Because each spin has two vertices, the target one and the source one. So G3. So now I need to put the magnetic number. So J1 once with N1, then J2 was already here. So here for sure it's going to be a M, and you have a sign. J3 is also going to be with a minus. And you can, you just have really to look at, once you have chosen your rotation, this is fixed, okay? So this means that here, for this given vertex, one is the vertex as a source. For five, it's as a target. Here it's the source and as a target. N3 minus M4. Okay, so this is the definition of your state, and you can, if you want to take the scalar product, the physical scalar product between two, we can also define the second one the same way, but with other on the same graph, but characterized by different spins. And then the question is, what is the transition? Amplitude. And maybe it's more clear to just say that for one of the graph, all the spin are equal to zero, meaning that then you're looking really at the transition amplitude between something with no geometry to something with a finite geometry with finite areas. Okay, so then this kind of degeneracy comes from the fact that the vacuum that is defined here in loop quantum gravity is kind of degenerate because it's what is the vacuum is no geometry. Okay, so there are some proposals to define different vacuum states that are based more on the spin foam approach, where on the spin foam approach, you really start from a topological theory. So the vacuum could be just kind of the BF. But in 3D, it's not really important. But in 4D, instead of starting from a node geometry, we can start from a topological theory to get to some geometrical degrees of freedom. So there are some proposals for different vacuums, but the initial one of loop quantum gravity that is still the one used every day is really on node geometry. Okay, so here if we put all the J to zero, we can get the transition repeated between a state with no geometry to a state with some geometry with finite areas. Okay, so what what is this explicitly? Okay, so let me write first with two functions here, and then we see how it simplifies. So I'm not going to do the calculation explicitly because I want to do this geometrical picture. So the idea is a transition between two different geometries characterized by these two different set of spin for the same graph. Okay. And here you can get So what we're going to, so now what I'm going to do is to write this in term. I'm evaluating that over group element. So if now I look at with this here, I'm going to get some Wigner matrices. Okay, so this is the way I'm going to write it here. So this is for the, my first function. Then I get something similar for the other one with my spin j. And then I get this product. So here it's a prime two. Okay, where I'm going to integrate over G, I. So I have one J by edge. Okay, so I have, what is a tetrahedron? A tetrahedron is four vertices, six edges, four faces. Okay, so you get an, and here now I have my three delta function, H1, H2, H3, that can also be, and so here, what this complicated expression is really just rewriting this explicitly, where these two functions now are evaluated on the spin network, okay, on my spin network function on the tetrahedron given by that, but that I evaluate on a given group element. Okay, so this is where this comes from. This object are just this. Ji and I. Oh. And again, you have this I label is labeling the edges of your graph. Okay, and so here, yeah, you have some integration here. You have some, you have four intertwiner, so Clebsch-Gordant, associated to the four vertices. And in fact, we can, yeah, this is after some rewriting and some recoupling theory, this is going to give you some well-known object that we're going to see again in the spin network, the spin foam approach in 3D that are, so what is this? J1, J2, J3, J4. So let me write it. And then give you, yeah, what this mean. Okay, so this is our result. If you rewrite, yeah, if you kind of rewrite this thing, figure out how many J, you have appearing here and here, then you can rewrite that this is in terms of this kind of object. So does anyone know what is this object? So it looks very like writing just this same thing, but the brackets here are important. And they mean something. So do you know what this object is? So it's not the same thing as just writing that here. This here is a specific object from SU2 recoupling theory. So anyone know that? OK, too bad. Super nice object. So it's called the SIGJ symbol. And yes, some kind of nice property. And we will see in the spin foam approach that this can be seen as a building block of the spin foam approach. And also, if you do this kind of semi-classical limit where you take the j goes to infinity, then it's related to red j action, which describe discrete gravity. So, but this we're going to see that in the spin form approach. So here, what can we say about this expression? So first, here we wrote the transition amplitude between two different geometries. Okay. So, you have a question?
No.
Everything is clear. Just okay.
I just can't see, but.
Ah, you cannot see. Okay. So it's just J spin label, and I denote some prime, and then. So what does it mean here? You consider two states on the same graph. Okay. So you have your graph, which is can be seen as a graph of. So here, what does it mean? We're looking at the simplest topological setting, which is just a sphere, okay? Because this graph can be seen as discretizing my sphere. It's the simplest non-trivial graph that I can get to discretize my sphere in terms of a graph. And now I'm looking at transition amplitude between different geometries, because the geometry are characterized by the geometry of my, all the geometrical information is in this spin labels. Okay, so I'm just looking at what is the transition amplitude between two different geometries for a given graph. So what here, what does it mean here? So first, what can we say? Is that this is factorizing, okay? It's almost like writing this psi 1, psi 2 with this square bracket, but it's a bit different. So here, this means that you have something like this. And so this means that now for the triangulated two-sphere, okay, which is what this graph represents here, there is only one independent physical state. And of course, you could see that if here you were putting one of the j to 0, you won't get a second sigj symbol. You will get only one, which will be the physical state of your geometry. Okay, but so here, what this is telling you is that we have, for the triangulated two-sphere, then we have only one physical state, one independent physical state. And so what is this physical state? It's just given let's write it explicitly, but this is not surprising, okay? Because indeed, the topology of the sphere is trivial, so we know that we expect 0 degrees of freedom. So this means that the radius phase space has indeed 0 degrees of, the radius phase space has dimension 0, and we get just one trivial state for our physical Hilbert space, okay? So here, what we are looking is for this specific graph. Where here, so this is a spin network, meaning that the Gauss constraint NB has been already implemented. Now we implement the flatness constraint using this delta. So this is exactly what we did. And what we would get is here, a product of where, again, this is the dimension of the spin representation, so it's 2j plus 1, and this sigj symbol. So this is in a given spin net, in a given basis, which is the spin network basis. So here, again, our physical Hilbert space is one dimensional. reflecting again that the reduced phase space for the spherical spatial hypersurface. So let's write it explicitly so that the reduced phase space for a spherical spatial hypersurface as a is zero. Okay, so we will see, so in the spin foam approach, that this state is also defines also the amplitude associated to the tetrahedron in the path integral. Okay, and yeah, so maybe this interpretation of this state is going to become more clear. So maybe just since I have 3 minutes, what is kind of what we expect, so let me give you, so any question maybe first, or do you want me first to give you the geometric, the in classical interpretation? Yeah.
Okay. What does the 6J symbol actually mean in terms of the SU2 recoupling theory?
So it can, it has really an expression in terms of, it's really coupling these four Clebsch-Gordan together that you have here. So so he has different expression, but one of its expression is really just an expression in terms of Clebsch-Gordan coefficient, telling you how to couple them together. And then, there are many kind of symmetrical property of this symbol. That so one important one is that you have a kind of recursion relation on this symbol given by the Biedernard identity. And this is really something that has been used a lot to kind of show the relation between this state and the spin foam approach, because you can really rewrite kind of this this flatness constraint and kind of project it to show that indeed you kind of get you get a defining equation for this symbol. Or for the physical state, or for the solution of the flatness that is equivalent to the defining expression of this symbol that is this recursion relation. So you get, to repeat what I just say, because I'm not sure it's very clear, there is also a very nice geometrical way to understand this this flatness constraint by kind of writing it really as an Hamiltonian instead of this flatness thing. And when it's written as this Hamiltonian, what you want to look at is the physical solution. And so you get an equation, kind of an equation like this. So to write this delta, this flatness constraint as an Hamiltonian, you just kind of project it on a different basis as the spin network basis. And then you can show that finding this is equal to zero is really equivalent to finding a defining expression for this thick J symbol, which is the Biedernard Elliott relation that really define uniquely the thick J symbol. So proving again that the physical state has to be this thick J symbol. But yeah, he has kind of nice geometrical interpretation, and in the, so since I have 2 minutes, I'm not going to do it now, but in the spin foam approach, it's important to look at kind of what is the semi classical limit of this object, if we kind of define what semi classical limit means, And then we're going to see that it's related to discrete gravity. Okay, so very quickly, on the classically, what are we expecting from a flatness constraint is that your hypersurface with its geometry can be, what does it mean that to impose that it's flat? This means that this hypersurface with its geometry can be embedded into a flat three space, okay? So this is exactly what I'm posing the flatness mean. And so from the point of view of a triangulation, what is going to mean is mean that if you look at a given function of your, so let's maybe do the drawing of what we have now. So this is my spin network and of my tetrahedron. So this, you should think about this link as glued together given a fourth vertex, okay? But this is the altered triangulation, which is also in the case of a tetrahedron, the dual triangulation is going to be also a triangulation. So it's not very easy to see. But anyway, so what is going to tell you? Can I do that or not? Yeah. So of course I did something a bit too short here. So of course, these are our straight lines, so it's not very obvious here, but we're still talking about flatness. So each of these vertex now from the Gauss is dual to a triangle, okay? And so now what is going to tell you, the flatness going to tell you, you can really write it classically as some condition on the dihedral angles between two triangles. So if I write T1 and T2 here, and it's really going to tell you how these two triangles are glued together and is going to enforce that the two triangles are gluing in such a way that they can be embedded in flat 3D geometries, okay? That they're defined flat 3D geometries. So this is really the meaning of this flatness constraint, is really telling you how to glue these triangles together in such a way that all geometry of your hypersurface can be embedded into a flat 3 geometries. Okay, so, and then, so if this is my hypersurface with its geometry, what is the flatness telling you is that it can be embedded at least locally into flat three space. Okay, so I'm going to stop here.